Matter of State versus Paulino Njango. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Assistant Deputy Public Defender Cody T. Mason on behalf of Mr. Njango.
Your Honors, Barbara Rosenkrantz for the state.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jennifer Kamisiak, Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Attorney General.
Welcome back, counsel. We're here today on a focused question that all the parties have had a chance to weigh in, whether the principles of CH apply in a matter such as this to service credits. So I just want to encourage you to remember this is not an opportunity to re-argue the entire case. We wanted to focus on that in particular. And Justice Albin may not be able to stay for the entirety of the argument. He will be participating and will follow up by reviewing the recording. Mr. Mason, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary. Thank you.
That's fine.
Your Honors, the question in this case is whether Mr. Njango's nearly 3 years of extra prior service credit should be applied to his period of parole supervision pursuant to the No Early Release Act. That is the question that was addressed in the appellate division. That is the question that was addressed in the petition for certification. And that is the question that this court should ultimately address and answer in the affirmative based on principles of fundamental fairness and double jeopardy. The state, however, is now asking this court to address a different question. Specifically, it is asking this court to reach back and relitigate the original award of Mr. Njango's prior service credits from nearly 4 years ago. In doing so, the state is asking this court to address an issue that is not properly before it and which has already been fully litigated. Moreover, it is asking this court to take these extraordinary steps based on mistake of law, because the primary, if not only, justification that the state has cited for doing so is State versus CH. And that case, contrary to the state's arguments, dealt solely with jail credit. It did not address double jeopardy. It did not address prior service credits and thus has no application. Rather, the appellate division applied the proper analysis in this case and correctly found that Mr. Njango was entitled to credit for all of the time served on his individual offenses. Accordingly, this court should reject the state's arguments, not disturb Mr. Njango's prior award of credits, and ultimately conclude that his nearly 3 years of prior service credits must be applied to his term of year of parole. So at the outset, Your Honors, CH should not be applied in this case because that issue is not properly before this court. Generally, this court will only address issues that are raised in a petition for certification or in a cross petition for certification.
So Mr. Mason, we're not asking you to walk away from that position. We understand what you've written and what you've said on that point. The question came from the court, so we would like your help, your analysis as to whether CH applies or should not apply in the context of service credits. Without forfeiting your position, please go ahead and move on to that.
All right, Your Honor. I do think that the issue should not be addressed because it's not properly before it under collateral estoppel and under principles of finality and fundamental fairness. If this court does reach the issue, it should at the outset not apply CH because it has no application to prior service credits. The issue in State versus CH was whether an individual who was sentenced to consecutive sentences for two offenses could have his jail time for pre-sentence custody on those offenses applied to both consecutive terms. In answering that question in the negative, this court interpreted Rule 321-8. It focused on the purposes of jail credit. It focused on that rule which entitles defendants to jail credit, and it focused on State versus Hernandez, which also only dealt with jail credit. Nothing from CH dealt with double jeopardy. There's no mention of that term. There's no mention of even any other constitutional protection. There is no mention of prior service credits. It's simply what has no application. And I think that's also evidenced by the 2017 appellate opinion in this case. That case also, conversely, does not address anything that has to do with prior service credits. Unlike the appellate division's opinion in CH, which was ultimately reversed, it did not rely on State versus Hernandez. It didn't use that type of language. Rather, it engaged in an entirely separate analysis, the appropriate analysis, which focuses on double jeopardy. The state and the attorney general are essentially arguing that there is no difference between jail credit and prior service credit. But everything from this court's case law, from the federal case law, shows that that is not the case. They are governed by different authorities. They are governed by different analyses. They are for different purposes. One is for pre-sentence custody, which is not punishment. The other one is a constitutional federal, state, and constitutional mandate for prior punishment. So CH has no application in this case. Submitted does not provide a vehicle to reopen the case at all. But if it is reopened on that basis, it should not be applied because that analysis has no application.
Mr. Mason, can I ask you a question to get an understanding of the scope of your double jeopardy position here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose someone is sentenced to three consecutive one-year terms.
Yes.
And they spend a year in jail while their sentence is on appeal. It is ultimately reversed, sent back to the court, and the court once again imposes the same 3 1-year consecutive terms. Does the defendant get 1 year service credit or in total, or does he get 1 year applied to each of the three counts?
So if I'm understanding correctly, there were consecutive terms originally, and then upon resentencing, the same consecutive terms were imposed again?
Yes.
In that case, it would only be one day. Those are consecutive terms. There were not multiple offenses that were being served at the same time. The difference
in that case, say again, in that case, it would count as?
It would count once toward the overall aggregate. If we're talking about it's consecutive and then consecutive or imposed again, it would be one day of prior service credit because the defendant was not serving multiple offenses at the same time.
But Mr. Mason, if in the chief's example, the 3 1-year terms were initially sentenced to be served on a concurrent basis, and then on resentencing, the defendant in that instance was sentenced to consecutive sentences, then would the 1 year spent on each of those concurrent sentences aggregate toward the 3-year consecutive sentence?
So if the individual was originally serving concurrent sentences, as in this case, then that individual was serving a sentence for each one of the individual offenses at the same time. In that situation, the defendant would have been not only serving those sentences, but earning credit toward each one of those offenses.
So the credit would follow the offense.
Yes,
so when that sentence comes back on the final appeal, the defendant has no more time to serve. Is that correct?
I would have to do the math to double check, assuming that was all, if there was enough prior service credit on each single offense, that would add up.
Yeah, the hypothetical, just to keep it simple, one-year sentence, 1 year actually served.
Okay.
So that full sentence is gone at that point, right?
Yes. Yes.
As I understand it, your position is simple. Under the Fifth Amendment, when you've served time, as credited by the Department of Corrections, you've served the time. That can't be taken away, can't be recharacterized at some future time. You did your time.
Yeah.
And therefore on a resentence under North Carolina versus Pierce, you have to be credited with that. In the example that the chief gave with 3 consecutive 1 year sentences, if you've served 1 year, that's all you get. Because you only served 1 year, but if you've served 1 year on 3 concurrent sentences, you've served time on each sentence under the Fifth Amendment. That's your position, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes. If it's three 1 year sentences that are run concurrently, each one of those individual sentences is being served at the same time. Under Pierce, because you are serving time toward that offense, if those sentences are vacated and any new sentence, which is the language that's in Pierce, any new sentences imposed, then those credits need to
follow. Counsel, so I'm clear, just so I understand this, because I never understood CH very well, as you know. If you have 3 concurrent 1 year sentences and you serve 1 year and there's a appeal and they become consecutive, you get credit for 3 years. Is that what you're saying? In other words, each of the 3 sentences is reduced by 1 year?
Yes, Your Honor, because
even though you only served 1 year, you're getting 3 years worth of credit.
So I think that's the key distinction here is it is not extra time. It is time that has been served on each offense. When a court imposes sentence, they don't just impose an aggregate sentence.
But if they're concurrent, you're saying if you get 1 year of jail credit for 3 concurrent 1 year sentences, if on appeal they're made consecutive, then even though you're not having a 9-year sentence, you've already served 3 years with that 1 year. Is that what your position is?
if they're served concurrently, then you have served a year on each one of those offenses. Yes, so
you, even though you've only served 1 year, you've served actually, the fiction is you've served 3 years. You've only been there for 1 year, but you've served three. Is that your position? Okay, I just want to understand.
So Mr. Mason, this is the second half of the hypo I've been trying to get to. Instead of having served that 1 year, you were fortunate to get a stay of sentence pending appeal. Otherwise, the facts are the same. It now comes back, and the resentencing is 3 1-year concurrent term, consecutive terms after having previously been concurrent. How much time do you have to serve under those circumstances?
Sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Just to clarify, so in that situation, the individual sentence is stayed and they do not serve any time in prison.
No service credits, exactly right.
In that case, they would not get any prior service credits. They wouldn't be able to.
So by virtue of having received a stay, you end up doing 3 years. If you didn't get the stay and did 1 year in, you end up having your sentence completed at that point. Doesn't that, for purposes of double jeopardy, sound like a windfall that arguably is unfair?
I don't think it's a windfall in that circumstances, because all we're getting in this case, or all the defendant is getting in this case, is exactly what he earned, which is a day for each one of those offenses. Simultaneous or concurrent sentences that are served simultaneously are completed at the same time. If you have, for example, a situation where somebody has a 2 and 5 year term run concurrent, and then through either their own appeal or the state's appeal, those are later reversed and made consecutive. Say you have somebody who has actually completed, they've served a little bit more than 2 years by that time. I think there would be a strong argument that that 2 year term, which was run concurrently, could no longer be run consecutively, because over 2 years has already been served while it was run concurrently. So you cannot increase the sentence under Schubert. I was just going to say, somebody in nearly the exact same situation who only serves a few days less, nearly 2 years, in that situation, if we do not award credits for that prior service, would end up having to serve that 2 year sentence all over again. They would end up spending more time in prison. They would end up spending more time on each one of those offenses, or at least on the second offense. So I think that there are different equities that are being dealt with in this case, but ultimately, the more just outcome and the outcome that is consistent with Pierce and the double jeopardy protections is to make sure that these credits apply, because it is simply credit for time that has been served.
It seems to me there are two issues here. There's a constitutional issue and what the Constitution commands, and whether or not the Constitution commands that you get credit for each charge for which you've served time. Then there's the question of this case, and whether or not it looks like he's getting a windfall. Then it looks like he's getting a windfall, because he had concurrent 18-year sentences, and that's what the initial judge intended. And what probably should have happened on resentence is that the judge and everyone should have figured out what was going on and denied the resentence and should have given him the concurrent sentences in the interest of justice. And we wouldn't be here today. What, you want to speak to that?
I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that does go to the sort of unfairness argument that the state has consistently been making about this. And the state is arguing that they were essentially victimized in this case, that Mr. Nijango tricked them in some way. But we are here because of the actions of the state. The state offered this plea deal. The state chose not to try to justify the concurrent sentences to begin with. They didn't petition on the 2015 held opinion that raise the question essentially of whether these could be run consecutively or concurrently. And they didn't take any actions once Mr. Nijango made clear that he was expecting to get credits for all the time that he served. He raised it at the plea hearing, at which point the state could have asked to renegotiate the plea. He may have filed a motion before sentencing, at which point they again could have asked the court to vacate the plea in the interest of justice. So the state has really sat on their hands throughout a lot of this, and it's through their own actions that they find themselves in this circumstance. I think as a general matter, double jeopardy and Pierce do require the outcome that the 2017 appellate opinion found.
Does it matter for double jeopardy purposes that it was his sentence that was appealed from and found to be illegal, not his guilt, not the finding of guilt?
Not There's no, I would not draw a distinction. No, no, Your Honor. And the other cases that have addressed it in other jurisdictions haven't really drawn. I'm not aware of any cases that have
been drawn. Does it matter that at the time of his resentencing, when he argued that he was entitled, I think he did it, have an argument about service credits, and the court said, no, 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 you're not basically getting double credit. Does that matter?
I think that matters just in the sense that it put the state on notice. I think that the extent that the state wants to argue that they were blindsided by all of this, they were put on notice. If they had maybe, you know, taken his arguments a little bit more seriously, if they had tried to address the possibility that he might actually get these credits, then maybe we'd be in a different situation. But they didn't. They chose to go forward with the plea. They chose to go forward with sentencing. So I think it's only relevant to the extent that it demonstrates that the state really kind of chose to roll the dice on here, test their luck, and they ended up being wrong. And Mr. Njango should not be punished for that.
The court could have, in the interest of justice, had it had the foresight to see the problem we're in today, had denied the resentence and said it's not in the interest of justice for me to vacate and give consecutive sentences because of the unjust outcome and the double jeopardy allegation he's going to get under North Carolina versus Pierce. He could have rejected it just on that basis, correct?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The 2015 appellate opinion did not vacate the plea. It sent it back for the trial court to determine whether these sentences were appropriate or not. The court, I think, could have pretty easily engaged in this analysis and found that the concurrent terms were still justified. But the state didn't even do that. The state renegotiated the plea because they also got a benefit from this. And that's another important thing to focus on, is that Mr. Njango is not—
What was the state's benefit? Because I kind of missed that.
They didn't have to go to trial, Your Honor. They chose to—
Okay.
They chose to offer him the plea. They chose.
Is that what they must do? They do. They offer pleas. You don't try all your cases, do you?
Do I try my cases, Your Honor?
All of them? You never take a plea?
I'm an appellate lawyer, but I don't take any cases to trial or take any pleas. But it's a negotiation. It's a contract. There is a benefit from both sides. The state was under no obligation
to. Yeah, but I don't see any benefit once he got sentenced to the concurrent 18. There was no benefit for their going along with a vacation of the sentence and letting a reconfiguration with consecutive sentences where Njango was going to be getting credit on each. That was a mistake.
I agree that they were not benefited from that aspect. I just mean from the aspect of the plea, that the state had different options. They could have taken their time and tried to deal with these issues rather than waiting nearly 4 years and raising it in a collateral appeal, and they didn't. But the double jeopardy analysis in this case was correct. It's not an anomalous outcome. It's not something that's unfair. I cite to a number of cases in our brief. The state cites to a few cases and theirs, as does the Attorney General. But there are not only more cases or other jurisdictions that have reached the same conclusion as the 2017 Appellate Division panel, but they've also done so in a much more consistent and persuasive manner. And I'm happy to go into any of those if Your Honors have questions, but I primarily just wanted to mention the Kentucky case because that wasn't addressed in my brief. Terrence versus Commonwealth, that is basically one of two published cases that both the state and the Attorney General were able to find that support their position. Terrence versus Commonwealth is as flawed as the other cases that the state relies upon, if not possibly more so. It first of all relies on Thacker, which is a case that just involved trying to apply credits from one consecutive sentence to another, so it has no application. And even in Terrence, the court stated, from a technical standpoint, it might seem that since he was indeed serving both sentences simultaneously, the appellant should be able to apply that time served to both sentences. The court avoided that outcome by finding that it was up to the court's discretion whether prior service credits should be awarded, which is clearly wrong under federal law. It's not wrong under our law. So I would submit that even one of the three cases, essentially, that the state has supported, one of which is unpublished, actually supports our outcome if you were to apply the law consistently. And beyond the general double jeopardy analysis that would apply in any case, there is a particular reason why the credit should not be taken away from Mr. Njango, whether as a whole or as applied to his term of parole supervision. And that is fundamental fairness, and it is also his interest in finality. This case was fully litigated. This issue was fully litigated nearly 4 years ago. The appellate division decided the case in Mr. Najango's favor in February 2017. This court denied the state's petition for certification, which led to Mr. Najango being released from prison, and then denied the state's motion for reconsideration, which was premised explicitly on State versus CH. We are talking about a situation where Mr. Najango has been out on parole based on the presumption that this was final for nearly 4 years. And I would submit it's not only Mr. Najango's expectation, but that it was also the state's expectation that this was final up until basically the attorney general joined this case. Because if this really was a situation where the state felt like this issue had not been fully litigated because the Supreme Court didn't address it, then they should have filed a motion to correct an illegal sentence. If they felt so strongly that State versus CH controlled this case, because clearly they wanted to take these credits away, they filed for emergent stays, they filed a petition, they filed for reconsideration. If they really felt that strongly that CH controlled, then they would have filed a motion to correct an illegal sentence and had this all litigated properly. They didn't because they, like Mr. Django, recognized that this issue was fully litigated and was done with. So I think that does go to the collateral estoppel issue, but also just goes to the matter of fundamental fairness in revisiting this, as well as the issue of finality. Because while this court has stated that a sentence can be challenged based on its legality at any time, in State versus Schubert, this court also said that the state has to act quickly. It has to act in a prompt manner. Otherwise, there will be a reasonable expectation of finality, even if the sentence isn't necessarily completed. And in this case,
Mr. Mason, your client is still serving a nearer parole sentence, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the application that he's made is to have any additional credits applied to that and be released from that. So on the question of fundamental fairness, the reason that I'm concerned about the question whether CH would apply here would be whether there's been a constitutional deprivation that should override the statute, and meaning that you not get the relief about having his nearer parole sentence shortened. I don't think anyone has suggested that he goes back to jail.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I don't think anyone is asking for that.
So explain the fundamental fairness concept in light of that, your position.
The fundamental fairness and finality arguments, which also go hand in hand with the collateral estoppel argument, are still based on the idea that going back to revisit this issue in any way that affects Mr. Najango, whether it is to return him to prison, which nobody has asked for, as you mentioned, or to deny him credits that he would otherwise be owed on his term of parole supervision, is still improper. It is still fundamentally unfair when we've had this issue that was fully litigated and has gone without challenge for nearly 4 years. For the state, I think to do this at this point goes against all parties' expectations up until the Attorney General stepped in, and would be fundamentally unfair, even if it just goes to the parole supervision, because it would be denying Mr. Najango of credits that he would otherwise be constitutionally entitled to. So for those reasons, Your Honors, we would respectfully request this court, at the outset, not go back and address the 2017 issue at all, based on collateral estoppel, because it's not in front of the court, and based on finality and fundamental fairness. However, this court does address the issue. CH has no application. Its analysis cannot be imported into this totally separate area of law. And rather, the appellate division correctly addressed these issues in 2017, as most other courts to address this issue have also found. So for those reasons, we would respectfully ask that this court not disturb the prior ruling and ultimately apply these prior service credits, which amount to almost 3 years toward Mr. Najango's term of parole supervision. And unless Your Honors have any questions, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. And by the way, speaking for one, I think you'd be a pretty good trial lawyer if you gave that a whirl at some point. Ms. Rosenkranz.
Judges, this isn't a game. The double jeopardy clause must be interpreted in a common sense way. We're dealing with a sentencing plea package. Defendant brought this all on himself when he unraveled that original plea package, calling for the two concurrent 18-year sentences and insisted on consecutive sentences. Defendant got what he wanted. He forced a new deal. That new deal called for a 10-year sentence for defendant stabbing and trying to gouge the eyes out of his ex-mother-in-law, and a consecutive term of 8 years for stabbing his ex-wife in the back of the neck. The appellate division disagreed with the trial court, who told this defendant that the prior service credit would only apply to the attempted murder sentence. The judge did do an analysis of that. In the appellate division gave defendant an unjustified windfall of double credit when applied to 7+ years of prior service credit to both sentences. Only legal magic makes defendant's newly minted 8-year and 6-month mandatory minimum equal to his original 15-year and 4-month parole bar. Let's not compound this error by giving defendant another break and reducing his nearer parole supervision. It is the total sum of the sentence that is of constitutional import. CH's logic of applying jail credits to the aggregate of consecutive sentences applies to prior service credits. Both credits serve the very same purpose. They both subtract the time defendant had been confined from his final sentence. The double credit in this case erased defendant's sentence for attacking his ex-wife. It's gone. If double credit is given, the state would be encouraged to seek maximum concurrent terms and avoid consecutive sentences so defendant serves the expected sentence. It would lead to the bizarre result that defendants serving consecutive sentences would be better off than those serving concurrent sentences. If defendant's concurrent sentences had remained, defendant would not have hit the double credit jackpot. Now I'm compelled to address some of defense counsel's claims in his brief and now. First of all, an illegal sentence can be corrected at any time, so collateral estoppel simply does not apply. And it doesn't apply for another reason. The legality of the double credit goes to the very heart of the defendant's claim that he was wrongfully imprisoned. It goes to the reasonableness of defendant's expectation of finality in his sentence. Also, the defendant raised the double credit issue before this court. An issue was raised whether a party devotes one sentence or 100 pages to it. It's before the court. Also, counsel didn't raise the double jeopardy issue before the appellate division, but asked for a remand to the trial court to craft an unnamed remedy. The state never conceded that the double credits were correct, but merely recounted the 2017 appellate division opinion. Counsel's client, defendant, raised the double jeopardy issue in a pro se brief that was later filed. Defendant invokes the fundamental fairness doctrine. This doctrine is used sparingly in rare cases where defendant is subject to oppression, harassment, or egregious deprivation. This isn't one of those rare cases. Defendant knew what he was getting into. Defendant cannot scheme like he's been doing throughout to keep the benefits of this generous plea and spurn what he views as downsides. If anything, fairness demands that this defendant doesn't hit the jackpot again and have his punishment for these vicious attacks further reduced. Now, I would like to distinguish some of the cases that counsel cites for the proposition that double credit is proper. First of all, Parker versus State and State versus Osborne really interpreted state statutes. Also, the Rabideau case, I hope I'm pronouncing that correct, makes no mention of double jeopardy. And also, State versus Owens deals with pretrial confinement and came to the opposite conclusion that this court did in CH. In the Christian case and the Thompson case, the state would submit just improperly extends Pierce. Double jeopardy in the sentencing context is really concerned that the defendant is sentenced to a within range sentence. And that's what this defendant got. Otherwise, if the court has any questions.
Ms. Rosenkranz, may I ask you a question? When a defendant is serving concurrent sentences, the department, for at least for state purposes, Department of Corrections, for every day in jail, the Department of Corrections is giving the defendant credit for one day on each offense. Am I correct about that?
That's correct. That's correct.
I mean, so for the purposes of state law, the Department of Corrections, they treat the concurrent sentences one day on each charge he's served it, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so the question is whether or not under North Carolina versus Pierce, you've done your time on each one of those, not only according to state law, but under the Fifth Amendment as well.
Your Honor, the state would submit no, and this is the reason. This defendant was the one who unraveled the original plea package.
So
you have to look at the sentence in the aggregate, and that
does that make for constitutional purpose? Look, I understand the windfall. There's no question that there's a windfall over here, but does the windfall change the Constitution? And could you have changed? Could you have stopped the windfall by saying, I'm not agreeing to the vacation of these 18-year-old concurrent sentences because of precisely what's going to occur under the Fifth Amendment? Go ahead.
Okay, Your Honor, first of all, for double jeopardy purposes in the context of sentencing, double jeopardy is concerned primarily with defendant not serving more time than that would go beyond the sentencing range called for his sentence for the crime he was convicted of. Here, the defendant's sentence is well within the sentencing range. And also, you have to look at it from a practical matter, and I believe that's what Lamar says, and some of the cases that the Attorney General also cited. You have to look at the whole deal. When the defendant was originally sentenced, he expected the 18 years. When he was resentenced, he expected the 18 years. And the reason for that is the trial judge, he did engage in that analysis, and he disabused the defendant of the view that he would get double credit. He said it's only going to apply to the attempted murder. So at that point, it was really up to the defendant to vacate the plea, move to vacate the plea if he was dissatisfied with it. No one anticipated that this issue would become so involved, let's say. But for constitutional purposes, he was sentenced within range. He received the sentence he expected. And again, NERA makes it clear that the term of imprisonment and the NERA parole are separate components.
Anything you'd like to add to your presentation, counsel?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Kamisiak.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Given the discussion this afternoon, I would like to focus on four main points. And my first point is exactly what this court had asked us to brief in the supplemental briefing, and that is whether the principles of CH apply to prior service credit, and the Attorney General submits that the principles of CH apply with equal force to prior service credit. And I just wanted to respond to defense counsel's argument that CH is not dealing with double jeopardy and CH doesn't mention double jeopardy. What I will say is that in CH, this court explicitly said that jail credits under the court rule work to prevent double punishment. So while there's not this exact citation to the double jeopardy clause, this court does say double punishment. And they work essentially the same way. As this court laid out in CH, jail credits under the court rule reduce periods of parole ineligibility and reduce the overall sentence imposed. And prior service credits work exactly the same way. So there's no meaningful distinction between jail credits under the court rule and prior service credits, such that, as this court said in CH, there can be no double jail credit, but under defendant's argument here, there must be double prior service credit.
Do you agree on that point, Ms. Kamisiak, that the jail credit which we've created by rule, mm-hmm. is not time spent for a penological purpose. It's given that purpose after the conviction and sentence is imposed, but at the time it's being served, it's not service on an offense for which the defendant has been convicted. And that's, to me, the meaningful difference between the jail credit scenario, which CH was dealing with, and what we have here, the service credit one, which seems to be on all fours with the discussion of how that time spent on an offense needs to be treated by Pierce if it's necessary for the court to resentence the person on the same offense.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that while it's not time, it's pretrial detention is not punishment. I think that's what Your Honor is getting at, and that's what defense counsel submitted in his brief. And we're not saying that pretrial detention is punishment, but it is treated essentially after the fact. If the person is convicted, it's treated in the same way as prior service credit and the way it's deducted. And this just jumps ahead to my third point, but there's at least four cases, and five if you count the habeas review, under similar circumstances to what we have here, where there were originally concurrent sentences that the defendant served time on that are later vacated and made consecutive. And the courts in these four cases that I laid out in my brief all found no double jeopardy violation when the prior service credit was only applied once. And that's People versus Inman, that's out of the Illinois Appellate Court, a 2014 decision. That's State v. Lamar, as Ms. Rosenkranz had mentioned. That's a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision, 2011, which was affirmed on habeas review, I think is important to point out, because the federal habeas court was considering the double jeopardy challenge and found there was that the Wisconsin Supreme Court had not unreasonably applied North Carolina v. Pierce. There was the 11th Circuit case, United States versus Rozier, 2012, and defense counsel had brought up before Terrence v. Commonwealth out of Kentucky. So we have at least five cases where courts have said just because it was a concurrent sentence and it's later made consecutive that you don't get this double credit. And I did want to highlight the Terrence case in particular, because I think the discussion of North Carolina v. Pierce is really informative, and we would urge the court to follow the reasoning of that case. And so in the Terrence case, the defendant was originally serving, as I mentioned, concurrent sentences. He had a 5-year sentence for false imprisonment and a concurrent life sentence for a rape. The rape conviction was overturned on appeal for trial errors. When the case was returned back to the trial court, the defendant pleaded guilty to the rape and received a 5-year consecutive sentence at that point. So he argued, just like the defendant is arguing here, that the 29 months he had served on both of those concurrent sentences had to be applied basically to both of those counts now. So he wanted 58 months of credit. Again, the defendant here successfully argued to the appellate division that his 2,692 days had to be doubled to 5,384 days. And in the Terrence case, again, just like the defendant here, he invoked North Carolina v. Pierce and said this is required. And the Court of Appeals of Kentucky said that Pierce was of little help and certainly not dispositive of the issue. And I think that the court got it right there, because the court pointed out that North Carolina v. Pierce was limited factually. North Carolina v. Pierce is a case where no credit was given. The defendant Rice in North Carolina v. Pierce, the companion defendant, served, I believe it was about 2.5 years on his convictions. They were vacated, and then he went to trial and he was resentenced, and the state of Alabama refused to give him any credit. And the Supreme Court of the United States said he has to get that credit. But as several courts have pointed out that we laid out in our brief, and the Terrence Court in particular, that you don't get this credit twice. Pierce was not a case that said you must get double credit. It's just you can't be in a worse position. You have to, that time has to be credited to you, but it's not that you get it twice. And in Terrence, the court said that the language in Pierce that the defendant here is really focusing on should be taken as a guide rather than a master and considered in light of the particular circumstances of the case.
Do you agree that sentence is imposed not as an aggregate, but on an individual offense?
Sentences are imposed on each offense, but they are treated in the aggregate. We cited the statute in our brief. I think it's 44.5 says that when there's consecutive sentences, they are aggregated.
But that doesn't answer the question of whether the individual sentence, which is getting credit from time served before, goes to the individual offense for which the sentence is imposed, as opposed to the aggregate, does it?
No, Your Honor, but our position is that it should only be credited once to the aggregate sentence, as these cases have that we laid out in our brief, as they have done, because otherwise you have this situation where you have double credit, or in the Chief Justice's example, even worse, triple credit, or even worse, potentially quadruple credit. I mean, where does it end? That they continue to, they get credit upon credit upon credit. We have to keep in mind, in this particular case, this defendant served 9 years and 2 months in jail, roughly, by the time of the resentencing. What the appellate division's decision effectively holds is that the double jeopardy clause requires this court to view that as if that time became 16.6 years of credit, which is what the defendant argued to the appellate division and argued before this court, that he had 16.6 years of credit. That's a legal fiction. And the post-North Carolina v. Pierce, in Jones v. Thomas, the United States Supreme Court made clear that the double jeopardy clause doesn't exist to provide these windfalls. So we have to look at the development of the double jeopardy law post-Pierce, which makes very clear that it's not about these unjustified windfalls.
Thank you.
So in this particular case, certainly there's a windfall, but then even putting aside this particular case, the legal issue, in all the other cases we cited in our brief, I would say they were cases that were more, the equities were maybe more in the defendant's favor in those cases. In at least one of the cases, the sentence had to be redone because of an Apprendi violation. Here, what we have, as Ms. Rosenkranz laid out in her remarks, was a defendant who got the benefit of concurrent sentences and then later came back to court several years later and said, actually, I should have received consecutive sentences because I stabbed my wife while I was out on bail for stabbing my mother-in-law. So in this particular case, it's clear it's a windfall, but even more broadly, we would ask the court and urge the court to follow the five cases that I just mentioned on the double jeopardy piece of the analysis and find that you don't get double credit, full credit, quadruple credit. You get credit one time, because that fairly credits you with the time you served in custody, which is what this court said in CH. You have to fairly credit them, and you give the credit in a way that maximizes the benefit to the defendant. So the defendant shouldn't be any worse off, but they certainly should not be any better off than if the judge had not made, you know, the mistake. And that brings me to my last point I just wanted to mention. Mr. Mason had argued really this was the state's fault, the state should have known better. And just a couple of points on that. First of all, we don't know what the judge would have done. First of all, no one foresaw that this is what would happen. If the state had foreseen that this is what would happen and he would get this double credit, certainly things would have been different. And I think we can be fairly confident about that because the state filed a petition for certification and a motion for reconsideration. So I would just point that out. But we don't know. It's not as easy as if to just say that the trial judge would have certainly now justified the concurrent sentences. Perhaps he would not have justified the concurrent sentences and would have wanted the state to start all over again. And then where does that leave us? And I think this is one of the most troubling aspects of this case, is that if the judge had refused to justify the concurrent sentences, then the only way, in the Attorney General's view, and the cleanest way to really still accomplish an 18-year sentence, a real-time 18-year sentence, would have been to have the defendant plead to one victim. So in this case, the mother-in-law, the attempted murder of the mother-in-law, and dismiss the indictment against the defendant's second victim, his wife, and basically say, sorry, but you're not getting any justice because you can't, because the double jeopardy clause requires this. The double jeopardy clause does not require this. The double jeopardy clause does not insist that the defendant gets immunity with respect to his second victim. And that's Jones v. Thomas says that very clearly. Unless the court has any other questions, I would just briefly wrap up by saying, and just echoing what the state said earlier, that sentencing is not a game where one wrong move results in immunity, but that's the very definition of what we have in this case, starting with the defendant's decision to upend his very beneficial plea agreement in this case and complain about the concurrent sentences. And given that the double jail credits were really awarded in error here, resulting in a dramatic reduction of the real-time consequences that this defendant had to serve, he actually got out about 4.5 years earlier than he should have. There's no constitutional violation in need of a remedy here, and there's certainly nothing fundamentally unfair about requiring him to serve the mandatory period of parole supervision. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mason, rebuttal, and if I could just start. We heard Ms. Kamisiak quote from Jones versus Thomas at the end, and there's a passage in that opinion that I'm hoping you can respond to. It. The opinion acknowledges that there are technicalities and technical rules that double jeopardy sometimes brings to bear. And then it says, neither the double jeopardy clause nor any other constitutional provision exists to provide unjustified windfalls. What relevance does that have here in this case?
So I think that is actually in favor of our position in this case, Your Honor, because this is not an unjustified windfall. This is credit being awarded for all time served. Jones versus Thomas has no application in terms of its actual facts. That's a situation where one sentence was, or one offense was vacated, the credits were applied to the other one, and the court said, you're getting credit for all the time served. These were originally consecutive sentences. There's no double jeopardy violation. That's totally different than this case. And what's helpful, I think the only thing that's actually helpful about Jones versus Thomas is that it makes clear that while double jeopardy can sometimes feel technical, it can feel procedural, it is no less important than any other constitutional right. And Justice Scalia in his dissent, which is joined by Justices Brennan and Marshall, and I believe also by Justice Stevens, also make this point, I think very eloquently, where they're saying there might be circumstances where it may feel like this is an unfair outcome, that this is not what was intended. But the reason or the significance of these technical rules is that they need to be followed. Without them, there are no rules. If we're making equitable decisions because the state feels like it was wronged, then the double jeopardy protections don't stand for much. So I think that's the significance of Thomas and that it actually supports our position in this case. In terms of the other arguments that were made, I do want to address just very briefly the idea that there would have to be a plea to just one of the two charges. The state easily could have just sought to include a contingent term in the plea. If there were unexpected credits received, then they could have invoked withdraw the plea. There are any number of mechanisms that the state could have but chose not to pursue in this case. So I think that's a false choice. In terms of the state's argument that any legal sentence can be essentially litigated forever over and over again, I think would come as a surprise and unwelcome surprise to the trial courts and the appellate division when they have to address the exact same issue that's already been litigated over and over again on its substance. So I don't think that that is actually legally correct and doesn't provide a basis for reaching back to the 2017 case in this case. Justice LaVecchia asked the question in terms of how significant is the aggregate sentence, whether separate sentences are imposed for separate offenses. That is something that is addressed in State versus Rodriguez and State versus CMC. It's 18 NJ191 and 97 NJ263. Those cases explicitly say that we are talking about individual offenses and individual sentences for those offenses. While the aggregate is obviously important, it is significant and needs to be assessed, it does not minimize the significance of the individual offenses. Indeed, aggregation is really more of an administrative issue rather than one that goes to double jeopardy. And that also serves to further show the fact that there is not an unfair reduction or really any reduction in the amount of time served in cases like this. And the state and the attorney general want to talk about how there is no offense imposed for one of the, or there's no sentence imposed for one of the offenses, how it was unfairly reduced. What happened in this case is that is not that Mr. Njango did not serve his sentence. It is that he served it in a different way. He served a portion of it concurrently, as he was allowed to do, as the court imposed. He earned credits toward each of them. He's serving the rest of it as it is now consecutive. His parole supervision is consecutive. If there was any remaining time on his term of imprisonment, he also would have served that consecutively. So there is no reduction. He just served it differently. In terms of the case law, I think the state and the attorney general is providing an incredibly generous interpretation of the states that they of the case law that they are relying upon. Terrence, as I mentioned, is just totally wrong. It says that the award of prior service credits is discretionary. The habeas cases, while they address the issue, they're applying an incredibly high standard to saying whether any rational court could have reached that conclusion. So they're unpublished district court opinions. They don't add much. And the cases that we actually cite, I think the distinctions that the state drew are actually incorrect. Parker out of Maryland, they did apply a court rule or a statute, but as the court clearly explains, that is meant to mirror Pierce. It's the same language, it's the same purpose. And it's the same thing in the Idaho cases. They are applying the one statute that relates to all credit. And then lastly, just in terms of what was happening in this case and whether prior service credits and jail credits are different. While they do share some qualities, that doesn't mean that they are the same thing. You know, a car and a bicycle both have wheels and they'll both get you from point A to point B, but that doesn't mean they're the same thing. A statutory right or a rule-based right is not the same as a constitutional right, and they are not treated in the same way. And in this case, the only way to deal with this is with the double jeopardy analysis. I think the state talked about legal magic in terms of reducing the sentence. The only legal magic that anyone is asking anyone to engage in this case is to treat prior service credit as jail credit, to apply a court rule instead of the Constitution. I think this court should reject that position, should in the first instance not address this issue, but if it does ultimately conclude that the appellate division correctly reached the opinion of awarding these credits in 2017, and that this court should apply the remaining credits to Mr. Njango's period of parole supervision. Unless your honors have any questions, I will rest.
Thank you, Mr. Mason, and thank you to all counsel.